Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English then.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach on this September 2nd, 2017. And you're certainly welcome to give us a call in here at 773-1400. Local area code is 254. And we have a caller on 254-773-1400. Welcome to the Personal Wealth Coach. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was reading that overall the European economies are doing better, and even Greece is doing good. I mean, what's up with that? I thought Greece was unfixable. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Greece isn't unfixable.
They have this
debt that's bigger than they can pay, right, even if they were fixed.
And Greece has been, by that terminology, unfixable for its entire existence. They go through these 15-year cycles with about 2 years being successful. You go back to the drachma and the number of times that the drachma got
devalued,
renumerated, they added zeros to the end of it or so on. And you just go back, it's about every 15 years, mm-hmm, going back as far as you want to measure, as far as they've had the control to do it.
Well, you know, things are better in Europe. However, the European Central Bank is still doing quantitative easing. In other words, they're still buying bonds on the open market. So they're still stimulating, right, the economy.
They still have unreasonably low interest, right, rates over there for exactly that reason.
For the first time since the crisis, all of the nations in the European Union actually turned in a positive rather than a negative growth.
In the quarter.
For one year. Now, it's not much growth, and they've been shrinking a long time, so they got a long ways to catch up. The unemployment rate in Europe is still about 9.1%. That's down, though, from 10.7% last time they checked it, so things are getting better.
Yeah, and there are still places where Spain, Greece, Italy, where the young working population has an unemployment rate in the upper 20%.
And the next announcement, of course, this has been going on a long time. The next announcement from the European Central Bank, the European Central Bank is expected to start tapering its quantitative easing. And if you think about, remember the taper tantrum of 2011. So we're talking about
they're falling behind a little bit.
They're where we were
6 years ago.
6 years ago, but their trajectory is positive at this point, which, as opposed to, there was a very serious question 6 months ago if they were going to slide back into recession and actually go into a death spiral, if you will. And that's still not over. There's still a lot of open questions, but it's a lot better than it was 6 months ago or a year or two ago. So, and by the way, we've talked about this before. One of the reasons that our corporate income, corporate growth in the United States, corporate profitability growth has been so good is a lot of what goes on in Europe is owned by American corporations. In other words, American subsidiaries like Dell. Dell's not a publicly traded stock, but Dell, I was looking at some pictures from the Lego Corporation. They were having a celebration of their 85th birthday of the corporation coming into existence, and there were Dell computers all over everybody's desk. So
In Denmark.
So the point is that one of the reasons that our stock earnings are doing well and our and the economy in the United States at manufacturing and so on is doing relatively well during a period of time when our GDP growth is very low is because a lot of what we're profiting from is what's going on in Europe and to a lesser extent in developing countries like China.
Yeah, and I would even say that the quarter we're in now, the third quarter, is going to have an even better reading than the second quarter. Second quarter was just revised upward in GDP to 3%. And I would say we're going to have 3.2 to 3.6 for the third quarter. I mean, Harvey may have an
impact on that. We'll see.
But the dollar falling right now, which it's either falling or the rest of the bundle of currencies out there is rising. It's really – there's no stable point. So it's really hard to say if it's falling
relativity
or rising.
Right.
Causes our exports, which is a big chunk of what we're seeing in the GDP right now – our exports are cheaper, which means that if Europe is recovering and they look around and they say, are we going to buy a Chinese knockoff or are we going to buy an American product, and the American product is getting cheaper by the moment, they buy the American product. And that's true in Germany and all across Northern Europe. It's true in Greece and in Italy. Basically, if you got the choice, you'd rather buy an American product. Almost anywhere in the world, you say you want to buy a Chinese product or an American product, they say an American one because the quality's higher and they can rely on it more as long as the price isn't too horrible. Well, the price has dropped. And that means just in that, we've got good news. On top of it, as sad as this is to say, Harvey hit probably the sweet spot for recovery. If they had hit in Louisiana or in Georgia or most of the rest of the South, if Harvey had hit and caused the same kind of disaster, the turnaround time on the recovery would have been like what we saw in New Orleans. There's just not a lot of thriving industrial or service businesses in New Orleans. Houston is chock full of businesses that are trying to make a profit. And so we're going to see a hit in the economy short term, but it's not going to be a long term one because they're going to plow a lot of money back into it. And in the end,
it'll be positive.
Next quarter, expect Texas to have a really high growth rate because that reinvestment, this is something that happened in Katrina, which was kind of glossed over. When we make refineries in the United States, it's a massive bureaucratic red tape process. It takes 12 years to get a refinery from paper into the breaking of ground. That's not finishing the refinery. That's just breaking ground. After Katrina, the refineries that were demolished were able to be replaced with better equipment, completely new refineries. In a lot of cases, the oil companies would just bulldoze the refinery and build it from scratch because they had plans to do it elsewhere, but they were not getting through the red tape. And expect that again. If you thought that we were leaving the rest of the world behind in oil and gas before, wait till after Houston's rebuilt. And what you're going to see is prices are going to go down drastically more because the refining technology has increased and we haven't been able to utilize the new technology. It's coming in now.
There's something like Harvey hitting Houston is going to be during this quarter, it'll probably be a hit. But for the following several quarters, it'll be a plus. And let me explain why. Property and casualty estimates right now are that there was about a $25 billion set of damages that property and casualty companies are going to have to pay. Here's the good news. Property and casualty companies in the United States have about $300 billion in reserves. $25 billion out of that is going to be a drop in the bucket.
That's so not going to kill any of the insurance companies.
It's not. It's, they
or not
they,
any of the big ones.
They had raised their rates following
Katrina.
Katrina.
Right.
And by the way, the majority of that apparently won't go to houses because that's FEMA stuff,
right,
or else it doesn't get covered. It's going to go to automobiles.
Right.
The number of totaled automobiles. So which means lots automobile manufacturer will have to go up to replace all the automobiles and trucks and all the equipment that was destroyed in the flooding.
We passed last week, heading back from the radio studio, a convoy from Arkansas of Arkansas Power heading south to help with Harvey before Harvey had even hit. And that was a long convoy. That was how many vehicles would you say was in that convoy?
Probably 20 or 30 at least.
Yeah, I would even say mid-30s. And that's just one convoy, the ones that we just happened to drive alongside. We're getting better on the corporate side of dealing with these disasters because we've had the government bungle them enough times in the recent past that the corporations don't count on FEMA to be prepared. They come
although,
in, it's still there. They don't count on it to do the immediate work that they used to.
And this is a very different – FEMA pre-Katrina was kind of a laid-back, oh, we'll never be needed sort of organization.
Right.
And they, a lot of people lost their jobs after Katrina in FEMA, and they're very serious about it now. As a matter of fact, a bunch of hotel rooms here in the Salado area where we are, it was noted as being filled up by FEMA agents because they couldn't find hotel rooms closer to the Houston area.
That being said, I mean, it's a horrible tragedy what's happened in Houston. And a lot of people have lost a lot in the process. But the fact that it happened there, it's really hard to call it a blessing because it's still a disaster. But it happened at the place that is most capable of recovering quickest. If you were to look at all of the major cities on the coastline of the United States, the city that is most capable of recovery, most capable of responding over the following couple of months, it's Houston. And Corpus Christi and Houston being close together like that, it's really nice.
Of course, there is a problem, and longer term, and that is FEMA is going to pay a tremendous amount of money to rebuild houses in floodplains.
Yep.
Because,
which is a problem because next time we have a flood in the floodplain, that's why they call it a floodplain, is because that's where floods happen.
Houston is in many ways a very Texas city in that they don't have any zoning ordinances. You can build pretty much anything you want to build wherever you want to build it without regard to zoning. Many other municipalities, as a matter of fact, every other major municipality in the United States says you can't build in a floodplain. It's because the zoning ordinances forbid it. In Houston, if you can build the house, if you put a subdivision in a floodplain and you can get people to be silly enough to buy the houses in the floodplain, then
it's
you can
hard
put
to
it
find
in
a good house in Houston. And just because it's a little,
it's a little low
in elevation. I kind of like it though.
It's built by the bio down here.
Waterfront. You can just step right out on your deck and be fishing in the bayou. It's pretty amazing. Bayous are pretty nice for.
Yeah,
connected to the ocean, but you know, sometimes they can be pretty high if the rain falls.
We have a major distortion in the United States in that the Federal Emergency Management Administration has the flood insurance program under that Congress created. And the flood insurance program says if you have a house in a floodplain, you can buy insurance from the feds. Because, very frankly, regular insurance companies won't cover it because there's a certain loss coming. It's not a matter of if there's going to be a loss.
They call it a floodplain because that's where floods happen.
And what we do in the United States is the federal government turns around and pays damages again and again. There used to be a 3 strikes and you're out deal on flood insurance, but apparently there have been places where people have managed to get around that. And we frankly, that's one of those things where Congress has dropped the ball. And many experts have looked at this and commissions have studied it.
Go to the Capitol building and you look at the floor of the House or the Senate, there's a lot of balls rolling around on the floor. They get dropped often.
But this, a logical approach to this, and by the way, it is the approach taken in most of Europe. You get flooded because you're in a floodplain. The government comes in and buys you out. Says, okay, here's what we'll pay for the property. We'll pay off your mortgage.
Stop building on floodplains. Go away.
But you can't build here again, and we're going to turn this whole area into a park. In Salado, there's an entire subdivision that in 2 different floods have been flooded, and they rebuild them each time, and the federal government pays for it. That doesn't make any sense at all.
But, I mean, just thinking about the look of Salado, if somebody were to say, I'm going to take all these houses, well, they weren't that damaged. That's the normal response. So, you know, we can fix it. This isn't a big problem. It was just a one-day flood. The waters have receded, and most of the time it's not flooded. I live here most of the time without water on the floor. So what's the problem? I'll just fix it.
It is a certainty that it's going to come again, and that's why private insurance companies –
won't cover
floods.
This is a great point, and you've done a segue here, and one that I would really like to take advantage of. Insurance companies are generally in business to not lose money. they're not all in business to make money, because there's cooperative insurance companies. They're called fraternal organizations. So like USAA for car insurance, not for life insurance, but for car insurance, is considered a fraternal organization. The company is owned by the people that have the insurance products. And that's, you know, if your insurance company sends you a dividend at the end of the year, it's probably a fraternal organization. Just make sure that you know which products are part of that and which products are for profit. Flood insurance companies do not go out to lose money. So when they look at a map and they say this is a reasonable expectation of when a flood should be, and we do want to have a little extra money to make sure that we can cover when our statistics are wrong, so we're going to charge a little bit more than the risk, just a little bit, then you have a profitable insurance company. There was a big, big move centered in Texas, but all over the country in the late 90s, all the way through the aughts, the decade of zeros, to buy life insurance as an investment, buy life insurance on someone else as an investment. And there was a huge move in charitable organizations to have the ownership of the life insurance policy. And then when the person dies, they get the insurance. It sounds like an amazing deal. Except that insurance companies are really good at charging a rate based on the risk. So if someone doesn't die and that insurance doesn't get paid out over a long period of time, you pay the insurance company more than the coverage. And that's something people didn't realize. And there's some big lawsuits out there from charitable organizations, big churches that thought that they were doing the right thing with their money because they had some advisor somewhere tell them, just buy a lot of insurance, pay the premiums on this, and you're going to make yourselves rich. So they used it with charitable money. They got their entire congregation to sign up for life insurance. The church paid for it.
And the people just aren't dying.
They're not dying. And it's really hard to ask your congregation to go out and die for a good cause when the good cause is money.
Jimmy Jones did.
Here, have some Kool-Aid, guys. And that's the problem. The big insurance companies have to charge higher rates on their premiums because the internal portfolios are making lower rates on the bonds, because insurance rates aren't just set on your chance to die. It's also on what they do with their reserve money. And interest rates being low, they're not making as much as they thought. So they're raising the cost of insurance, and that's what the big lawsuits are about. Well, you're raising the cost of insurance. Well, it says...
It says we can do that.
In the contract, and that's why they call them contracts. It says that they're allowed to raise your rates within a certain scope, and they can raise your rates at a pretty eye-watering way, and people say, well, why would they do that if less people are dying? Less people are dying, they should be lowering the rates, except that they have to have reserves on hand so that they can pay insurance premium, the insurance costs to people when they die. And at the end of this, when you have these rate increases, and the lawsuits are based on, we think you're doing this based on race, and that's an illegal thing. They're not even allowed to look at that in the insurance quote. And there's some really big lawsuits out down there. The reality is, the reason why the lawsuits are there is because these people thought that they were buying a good investment by betting against professional actuaries and saying more people are going to die than that. They didn't even know they were making that bet.
What they did, if I understand it correctly, is they bought off of what's called a ledger that the salesman showed them. And the ledger assumes current insurance rates at that time, which are below the guaranteed rates. And it assumed a certain rate of return in the insurance company's portfolio, both of which have been not there. Because in a balanced portfolio, in a low inflation environment, you get a lower return. In a and as Jake said, the internal portfolio that the insurance company uses to pay death benefits, it's also getting a lower rate of return. So they have to raise the what they're charging people up towards the guaranteed, rates.
Even though fewer people are dying, it's the insurance companies in business, particularly the ones in these lawsuits, to make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not making a profit, they're allowed to raise rates until they do make a profit. And mm-hmm. that's what we're seeing, and the lawsuits are out there. And I'm saying this because insurance companies look at risks in a very scientific manner. They say, how likely is it to have a disaster here in these conditions? If they're charging you a high rate, it's probably because there's a high risk of something. Keep that in mind when you're buying insurance and you think you're getting the better deal on the insurance company. There's ways of lowering your rates. Getting a higher deductible is a good plan if you've got some cash sitting aside to hit that deductible when it becomes apparent. But insurance companies, I wouldn't bet against them when it came to the risk that they're measuring.
Anybody that tells you to do so is wrong by definition. Hey, change the subject a little bit. By the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach on KTEM, and the telephone number is in here. Telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. If today is September 2nd where you are, then you're certainly welcome to give us a call or contact us at either Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com with any question you have. I mentioned the conundrum earlier, and it has to do with, it shows up in the insurance issues. One of the things we've done is assumed a certain rate of inflation and a certain rate of growth in economies and things like that. But we're in a very interesting position right now that for people who study economies, as I said, is a conundrum. That's my word for the day. Global inflation, and that's all the nations in the world averaged together, has hit the lowest level since 2009. And in 2009, obviously, it dipped for a short period of time to a slightly lower level than we see today. But if you go, we were obviously having a severe recession at that point, and that's a good reason for inflation to go away. But if you go back before that, the last time inflation was this low across the globe was in the Great Depression of the 1930s. Yet global growth has moved up now to over 3% a year. 3.7, I think, is the current estimate for this year. And so we've got healthy global growth and global inflation down around 2%. Now, that is one of those strange things that indicates to us, to economists, that something fundamental has changed. And what's changed fundamentally, we can actually find it in history, and that is back in the first half of the 19th century. There was a major shift that went on where we had regional areas, the economic areas in the United States, and New England was a region, and the Southeast was a region, and the Midwest, which was not, it's the West then. Obviously, it's the center part of the United States today, and we still call it the Midwest. But each region in the United States had its own economy, and in many cases was using its own money, banknotes, and was functioning independently. But as the railroads came into play and goods manufactured in New England could be purchased fairly easily in the South or in the Midwest or someplace else, the economy changed, and it changed very profoundly in the process. And there was a lot of political upset. We had a president at the time who ignored the Supreme Court and basically ignored all the conventions and was a very populist president, the one who is the favorite of our president today, Andrew Jackson. And we're going through another one of those conditions today. We're going through a condition where the assumptions we have made about economic affairs, for example, jobs and imports and exports and things of that nature, all the things that are hot topics in the political world, the meaning of those words is changing as we go forward. And Jake and I have talked about this a lot. The fact is that if you buy an automobile in the United States today, even if the parts were made in the United States, they were probably assembled in Mexico and shipped back to the United States. So was that car made in the United States, or was it made in Mexico, or does it make a difference one way or the other? It's like
not just Mexico these days; it's also Canada. And
right.
This is funny that you're talking about that, because I've got a graph up here on the NAFTA impacts, what the trade deficit or surplus is with Mexico and Canada and different areas. And in automotive, we definitely do not have a surplus with them by the way this is calculated. There are American companies that are building
in all the countries.
Right, in Canada. I mean, I have a Ford. I have a Ford Flex, and I really enjoy my vehicle. It's a good American-made car from Canada. It was built in Canada. Well, Ford built a plant in Canada. Shareholders of an American corporation received the profits from that in some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
The Canadian people were the ones that built the car. So was NAFTA a success or a failure there?
Well, you probably also find that a lot of your electronics in there, the generators or the alternators, whatever, built by Delco, which is an American company, and probably was built in the United States, shipped to Canada, put in the car in Canada, and the car is shipped back to the United States.
In many cases, this is just crazy, and I've got some other things to talk about on the same subject. When we're talking about agriculture, by the way, people think, well, Mexico, we get a lot of agricultural products from Mexico. In fact, one of the big things about NAFTA is when people talk about avocados, that seems to be like the rallying cry for everyone. Well, do you want your avocados to be 20% more expensive? As if avocados are part of every meal. For some reason, that was the example that was given. We have had, for the majority of NAFTA, the vast majority of NAFTA, a trade surplus with Mexico on agriculture. We've had a surplus with Canada on agriculture. So when we're stopping Canadian imports of lumber,
right?
By the way, do you know where we're replacing that lumber from? You'll enjoy this.
Tell me.
Russia. So we're not buying from Canada because we say they're subsidizing their lumber and that's a violation of NAFTA. So instead we're buying from Russia, who subsidized their lumber three times as much, but they're not in a free trade agreement with us. So we'll still buy it. I think that's ludicrous, but that's when politics gets involved with trade. It should be based on price. Canadian prices are a lot better than Russian. They are subsidized. There's a violation of NAFTA there that should be fixed. But instead of using them, we've now have to turn to Russia at a much higher price, much higher subsidies from the Russian government to buy wood that, because NAFTA was violated.
That raises the price of housing in the United States, which means that fewer people can buy houses, which means that there are fewer jobs available to people who want to build houses.
Right. So energy. This is another one. Canada has we have a deficit with Canada on energy. But again, it's on the books. They ship a lot of petroleum to us in its unrefined state.
Oil,
tar oil, stuff that requires a lot of work in order for it to be used properly. So they ship it to us, and we're not shipping a whole lot of petroleum products back to them. They have a fairly small population. We charge them, so this is still a Canadian product when it comes down through the pipelines. It's owned by the Canadian companies or American companies in Canada in many cases. So Exxon has a lot of drilling going on in Canada. It's shipped down to be refined in the United States, which is something American companies charge for. It's a profitable thing for us. It's very nice for us to be able to refine the products from the rest of the world. We get paid for it. Then it's sold. That oil and gas is sold, generally, again, by the same company, which is an American company. And yet we have a trade deficit with Canada there. We have a surplus with Mexico, just as a side note. We've just gone into the surplus zone back in 2014, and it's getting bigger and bigger because we can we've got a lot more cheaper petroleum that we can sell to them, and it's undercutting their companies because their companies were not running well. It was government subsidies and so on. So anyway, I'm saying that because when we're talking about trade, it's a complex issue. This is a big one. Textiles. Big numbers here to talk about. We have a massive surplus when it comes to textile trade with Canada. We sell them a lot more fabrics and clothing than they sell to us. We are selling more fabrics and clothing from the United States than we ever have in the history of the United States, and very much like any other industrial area. In 1990, we had 1.6 million people working in textiles. In 2016, we have 360,000. So we've got a million less people working in textiles. We've got a huge trade surplus with most of the world in textiles. We're producing more textiles than we ever have before, but we have a million fewer jobs. We have a drop of somewhere around 80% of the jobs in textiles. We can't blame free trade for that. We've got to look at how we're producing textiles. Technology is to blame for that. And I'm not trying to hit any political spectrum here. I hate that trade is political at all. It should be based on dollars and cents, on profits and what the corporations are making here, there. It should balance out, and we can see it in the earnings results of the S&P 500. We're doing great when people are talking about this
stuff. Well, getting hard on China, for example, and setting up a trade war with China is something that every president that's been elected recently has said he was going to do and
winds up not doing.
And so far, none of them have done it, thank God. One of the things that we really don't get, I think, at the gut level is the fact that we are no longer an island nation that can function on our own.
Were we ever an island?
We have water on both sides, and we laid claim to the entire Western Hemisphere under the Monroe Doctrine. So we effectively became the dominant nation on this island called the Western Hemisphere, and we thought we can get along. And by the way, in the Monroe Doctrine and a lot of the thought process prior to World War II is we can just afford to ignore Asia, and we can afford
it
to ignore
the rest of the world.
The rest of the world, and we'll go about our business, and we'll do just fine. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way.
Or fortunately.
But it's just like
it's hard to say. Is it good or bad? It's just it is. This is the way it is right now.
We had the impression for a long period that we could ignore what's going on in Afghanistan, that nasty place out there, and it wouldn't have any effect on us until
they swatted us upside the head, woke us up enough to say that they're a threat.
And by the way, I support the president's decision to put more troops into Afghanistan, advisory troops, because very frankly, we cannot afford to have Afghanistan reignite as a place that attacks can be launched on the United States.
Right. It's too central in Asia with too many roads out of it
And it's
to fund or train terrorism everywhere.
We just simply, following World War II, we made a couple of decisions as a nation. Number one, what goes on in the rest of the world is going to affect us. And
right.
Number two, it's far better to fight the bad guys over there than over here.
Right. And this is important when we're talking about Syria. Syria is a nasty situation. We wanted to knock out the Islamic State. But the roads out of Syria are pretty limited. You can either go across the Mediterranean with the refugees. Well, there's some good monitoring on that in Europe. Or you drive up through Turkey. Well, the Turks don't like that. The Hungarians don't like that. That whole pathway up through, you're getting stopped and checked on a regular basis. Afghanistan, that is not the case. Just about every border with Afghanistan is porous. They can just take all of their explosives and equipment and go wherever they want. So Afghanistan is a lot more important strategically to the terrorists than Syria ever was. You know, Syria and Iraq were I guess as a rallying cry and a statement and like their moral support
Europeans
concept.
Europeans might disagree with you that a little bit about that, because a lot of Europeans, people who were citizens of European countries, went to Syria and then came back and blew stuff up.
Right. Yeah. But, and that's an issue, that there's not that many Europeans that would fly to Afghanistan to train to be a terrorist and come back. It's a lot harder to get there. It's a lot easier to get out.
Well, the key here is to recognize that the world is integrated economically, and any attempt to cut that off would hurt us a lot more than it would help us. It's kind of like one time, and then people still talk about Texas being able to exist independently. It can't. We import a lot, we export a lot, and we are integrated with the rest of the United
States. Talk about porous borders. I mean, just how easy is it to go into Oklahoma or Arkansas or California, for that matter?
The point that I want to make here is it's really important to recognize, for example, in our economy right now, we have one major restricting point. As an economy grows, it always hits restricting points where this is the thing that's blocking faster growth.
And we can see more coming in the future, but this is the one right now.
The one that we're seeing right now is we have a low-skilled labor shortage. Now, we also have some problems with high-skilled labor.
That's a constriction point that's coming in the near future.
We can fix that high-skilled one, and it's not very popular, but Microsoft has done it, and you just mentioned Ford has done it. When you need high-skilled laborers, what you do is you move your manufacturing or whatever you've got to wherever the skilled laborers are.
If we want that not to be the case, we either increase immigration or improve the quality of our own education.
And the quality of education improvement is something that would take many years.
That's a big project, one that we should probably get started on, but, you know.
But the big restriction in the United States today, if we wanted, we need to fix our infrastructure and we need to build more houses, for example. We need more workers and we need to be able to import the materials to do these things. And if we restrict that in the name of nationalism or nativism or whatever you want to call it, if we say, okay, we are going to restrict the number of people coming in from south of the border.
Just expect to pay more for houses.
Well, not only will you pay more for houses.
You just can't get the house. That happened in Japan.
But this
is still happening in Japan.
This is an issue where the rest of the economy then cannot grow as fast, because we don't have those people who traditionally have built houses, building houses and paying money. And this is the other thing that's important about this. If you allow legal workers into the United States to build houses, for example.
Hear him say legal, not illegal.
Then those legal workers pay into the Social Security system. They pay into the Medicare system.
They pay taxes.
And they pay taxes. And we are losing the bottom end, the working bottom end of the tax base is where we're losing people. And they don't pay as much tax per person as another person does, perhaps. But if there's a lot of them, we get a lot of money from that. And that end, it simply is gradually drying up. Then you throw in the fact that the people who previously were the contractors who built the houses, who made good money, who were paying taxes, aren't building houses anymore, so they're not making as good of money, so they're not paying the taxes, and we really need to have immigration come into the United States.
Right. The other end of this is a psychological one. This is a psychological reason that can cause markets to get overheated when the politicians pay too much attention to it, though. And that is, when someone owns a house, they are more productive than when they're renting. Why that is very, very hard to define, or very, very easy to define. Why is it that people tend to work harder when they have kids? Why is it that people tend to work harder when they own part of the company? It's part of the American dream. When you can see the results of your labor and keep it, you tend to work harder. It's why capitalism beats communism hands down over and over again. If we have a constriction point that lowers productivity by not allowing people to own homes, and household formation rate is really low, a lot of millennials that are saving lots of money are still living with their parents, because when they go for a house, and the average or the median price of a house is $300,000, and they have worked for the last 8 years to save up $60,000, and they see it all go on one house, they would rather have the houses be less expensive so that they can afford them, particularly as interest rates go up, so that, you know, with a combination of a house payment and student loans, it's very difficult for that same kind of ownership and productivity to kick in. This is something that we've expected as our due since the founding of this nation. The whole concept of going out and owning property and building a house, it's why we settled this continent. To have that be the construction point based on not wanting immigration to come in, that seems ludicrous.
Probably ought to do some commercials.
Yes.
Whatever we have that passes for commercials. And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and this is KTEM. And if you'd like to give us a call, telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. If today is September 2nd, and this is not a rerun, or you can email us at either Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. And we'll be back on the other side after these words from KTEM. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here, if today is September 2nd, where you are, is 254-773-1400. I've got too many numbers rolling around in my head. You know, kind of summarizing what we've talked about the past hour and 45 minutes or so. Markets were up this week. They're up quite a bit for the year, up around almost 10%. They're around 10% for the so far this year, and about 13% from this time last year, which is pretty astonishing. And by the way, you should not expect that going forward. This kind of growth that we're seeing in the markets may go on for a while, but the long-term growth, long-term average return at the S&P 500, even if once we pull inflation out of it, is around 7%. And if we have 2% inflation, which is what the inflation, which is what the Fed hopes for but hasn't been able to achieve, then it'd be around 9%. And since you shouldn't be 100% in stocks, that means you shouldn't get that higher return over the long term. And so that's reasonable expectations. GDP growth was revised by the Commerce Department up to 3% for the second quarter, 3% meaning annualized 3%. Looks like it's going to be a really good in this quarter. We don't know what it's going to be. They're guessing 3.4, but we won't know until after the end of the quarter and several estimates have gone by. Manufacturing is up. Inflation, year over year, 1.4%, which is well below the Federal Reserve's goal of 2 and is a conundrum. It's one of those things that, and wage growth up, still up about 2.4, 2.5% over the year. One of the oddities, well, not oddities, one of the factors in wage growth, by the way, is that supervisors saw most of that wage growth. The persons, the people who are, that's among hourly workers who are supervisors. The people who are not supervisors didn't see much of any wage growth at all during the last year. And we've had very, very little inflation. Basically, the wages are keeping up with inflation, but that's as far as it's going. So there's really no danger of the economy overheating at this point because it's just not heated up. And that's because we're in a new world and things are changing. What are the threats coming forward? Do you want to talk about some of those?
Sure. Yeah. We mentioned the constriction point in low-skilled wages.
Low-skilled labor.
Yeah. I mean, that whole area where we just can't find people to work on houses. Well, that is an upward pressure.
Or roads. Or bridges.
That is a hindrance to expanding anything logistically. If we're hitting a point where long-term it's not going to be a problem. Long-term, we could shut off immigration and for the low-skilled area, and we'll come up with technology to replace it. It's already happening. I mean, the fact that when houses are put up, it requires one-tenth of the people that it did 20 years ago. and that you've got machines that are doing a lot of the work, nail guns and so on.
This is a fascinating. I just got through reading this. According to the Commerce Department, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and the Labor Department, construction, outdoor construction,
mm-hmm.
has been extremely resistant to productivity increases, and so their productivity really hasn't grown at all in a long time.
That is really, really hard for me to fathom, because you, I was around while you were having a house built,
mm-hmm.
In the late 90s, early 2000 era. It was unfortunately a very long construction project. They weren't using nail guns out there. They were hammering. And there was one guy on the team that really had a lot of skill, and he could knock that nail in there with one smack every time. He wasn't from the United States, but he was very highly skilled in that area. Now, we've just had a house built right next to us, the street, and you see a lot fewer people with the nail guns going. Now, I agree with you when it comes to electrician work and plumbing work.
The total cost of building a house in the United States, basically, when you look at what it costs to build the house in the way of labor,
uh-huh.
and their output, dollar for dollar,
right.
has not moved
right.
in 15 years.
It hasn't moved at all.
According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Except that we've got fewer people doing the same work.
Right, but they're having to pay because you can't outsource the electrician, you can't outsource the plumber.
Right.
So the wages have gone, in other words, they haven't really automated. It's a matter of who's skill. If you're talking
right.
about the master electrician who's in there and they call a rat, the guy who assists him.
Right.
The rat is still getting low wages, but the master electrician's wages are going up fast.
Yes. And long term, this is just like truck driving. Truck driving wages have been consistently rising because there's been a shortage of them for a long time. Well, we're coming up with trucks that drive themselves.
And that's coming down the road, right?
Pre-manufactured homes where they come in with a wall that already has all the wires in it.
There are some other threats
coming
out there. For example, the ongoing threat that when Congress finally gets back to work, they've got 12 days to raise the debt ceiling, set
right.
a budget, and do a whole lot of other things. If everything doesn't go exactly right, that would cause a blip. It won't cause a recession. It won't cause a bear market, but this is a 7 year, and like in 1987, and in 2007, and if you go back, we get these blips typically in September and October where the market suddenly goes bloop and falls and then returns pretty quickly back up to hit new highs. So be aware that this type of thing, I don't know why it happens in 7 years.
This may be the 7 year that it doesn't.
It may be, but
years that ends in seven.
When they occur in those years, normally, 2007 obviously being the exception, normally it's a short-term blip. And if Congress does something stupid, it's a short-term blip. If there's a whole series of things that could go wrong in the near future, none of which have the capability, nothing that we see has the capability of derailing the economy and putting us into a recession.
Right.
A market crash, a bear market is triggered by a recession. And the problem is when you go into a recession, you really don't know you're in the recession until well after the fact. And
all bear markets. Yeah, I know.
Every bear market. I just got through looking at the report in the Wall Street Journal on that and in Barron's. I'm not talking about every correction. Every major bear market in the 20th century has been accompanied by a recession. You see, the 1987, there was no recession. Some people have called that a bear market, but it in essence was just a severe correction. It did dip down far enough for a very short period of time to technically call it a bear market, but immediately recovered. So we're talking about the kind of bear market that can devastate your portfolio is accompanied by a recession. There's no sign of a recession out there. And despite all the noise, Alan Greenspan was quoted this week. He had an interview, and he said the stock market is not overpriced. He thinks it's fairly priced at this point and will rise with earnings. But the bond market, in his words, is in a bubble. And he said eventually things will come back to normal, Eventually, interest rates will come up, and when they do, the bond market could fall very dramatically, very quickly. That would cause a short-term dip in the stock market until people woke up and realized that's good news, not bad news. But we'll keep our eyes on that, and we'll keep talking to you about it. And we're about out of time for this hour.
Yes, we are.
So if you'd like to give us a call and talk to us about wealth management and how to manage your portfolio, you're certainly welcome to do so during the week. We have live people. If there's a voicemail over the weekend, we'll call you back. And that's 254-947-1111.
Yes, and you can reach that same voicemail during the week or during the weekend, to real live people during the business hours, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly, Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. That's thepersonalwealthcoach.com. You can go to that webpage or tpwc.com.
Now, are we going to do the show next week? Are you going to do it by yourself? Because I'm not going to be here.
I'm going to skip next week, and I'll do the following week, and I'll skip the week after that. So,
okay, so
we'll have our summer vacation in September.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah. That's when the market is supposed to crater or something.
Right,
in September.
Right. So next week will be a rerun. You'll probably be hearing this on the 9th as well as on the 2nd.
So if you didn't get enough of us this week, you're certainly welcome to tune in.
Clear, balanced. Your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.